Ta-dao! Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 335. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
Johnny, it is my extreme pleasure to be here with everyone tonight.
Back to you, buddy. Guillaume Veillette is here.
If you catch me saying niche instead of niche, I'm not being a snob, it's just how it's fucking said.
You're actually saying Nietzsche.
And James Jones.
What the fuck's wrong with you people?
I don't know.
These are terrible intros.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's a lost art. What can I say? Luckily, I don't really have to do the intro for myself because I'm the first one to talk.
That's it. I'm hosting next time. I'm doing the intros.
We'll see about that. So we're going to do new business in just a sec. And later on, we've got listener mail. And of course, the big topic for listener mail is the news today that Satoru Iwata is the new CEO of Nintendo of America. There's so many different explanations and theories and repercussions of this, and I'm excited to talk about it. But we're going to try to hold ourselves off just a little bit so we can tell you about some video games. One last thing before we get started, just in case it takes you a couple days to listen through the episode, I wanted to tell you up front that Mega Man 3 won the poll in Retroactive. Actually, it was not even close. I thought it would be really close. But Mega Man 3 won with about 66% of the vote over Mega Man 2. Pretty shocking, I think. And again, it's not necessarily what game people think is the best. It's which game they wanted us to discuss. So keep that in mind. But I am thrilled to have a chance to talk about this game. And so we're going to be playing it, and we will be talking about it next week. That is the current plan. So I just wanted to let people know up front, because if you want to participate in Retroactive, either by just playing on your own or posting something in the forum thread that we can quote next week during the discussion,
that we can mock,
probably not mock, but probably talk about, that thread is open already, and you can go to the website and find it. And I hope you will participate, but you're going to have to be pretty fast to get your comments in. So with that said, we are going to move into new business right now, and James is up first with one of my favorite games ever.
I'm sorry. I have almost reached the bottom of the big pile of GameCube, and today's stop on the Dante's Descent into the Inferno was Donkey Kong Jungle Beat, or as I've now known it, the reason I needed to get hand moisturizer on my hands. Because I just decimated my hands playing this game for about 2.5 hours straight.
You just need to tape up your fingers like a bongo player.
There you go. So if you don't remember this game, or you were, I mean, this game's like, what, 12 years old at this point? So
no, it's from 2005.
Is it really?
Yeah, 8 years old.
Okay, that's fine.
It's a pretty late GameCube game, yeah.
So the people listening to the show commensurate with the intelligence on it weren't born yet, but most of our audience probably was. So Donkey Konga, I guess, was the first Bongo's game. Nintendo went through this weird phase at the end of the GameCube where they released a bunch of accessories for it. They even talked about how that was their strategy for extending its life. That strategy just ended up being the Wii. But besides that, they ended up putting out, amongst things like a microphone, they put out a set of bongos. It's two bongos, a right one and a left one. It's also got a start button and a microphone that can nominally detect clapping, but basically just detects any loud noises as a clap.
Mm-hmm.
That is a thing that Nintendo put it out, I presume because they assumed it was a good idea.
Donkey Konga,
which
Namco
is a weird,
was
like, proto-plastic instrument game in which Donkey Kong bongoed out to various songs. I guess there are mostly Nintendo themes, but there was pop music in there too, wasn't there?
Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star is like the hypest shit.
Yeah, that's famed for its percussion lines.
Yeah.
that game, the song selection is very different between the American release and the three Japanese releases, which had much more pop music and much more video game music included, and right, much less public domain bullshit like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But I just wanted to note, the DK bongos that were designed primarily for Donkey Kong and later sort of repurpose with the idea of what if we could make a real kind of 2D platformer with this weird controller. It's not really a prototypical rhythm game. It's really kind of a distilled simplification of the Beatmania franchise that was already extremely popular in Japan. It was Nintendo's attempt to distill this popular genre into a simpler form that they could sell to a broader audience. And they did. And they even brought it to America at a time when that stuff typically did not come over to America. So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah. It's very weird because right now sitting on the floor in front of me are two plastic Donkey Kong barrels with white faux leather tops on them that are also drums. It's a very elaborate piece of kit, all things considered. It comes in this big carton that contains it and the game. So when I removed it all, I was just sort of fumbling with it going, this is really odd. So I hooked it up, hooked it into the Wii. Weirdly, the game does not support 480p, which is super annoying, but I managed to get it to working on the TV.
That's one of the advantages of the Wii re-release, is that it does support progressive scan, but it does not support the bongos, which means it's fucking worthless.
Oh, God, it's brutal.
It is. What's weird is that it was a late Nintendo GameCube game that doesn't, which means of the three games I've bought, most of which were late GameCube games from Nintendo, they don't. But the two early Capcom games I bought do. Because why? I don't know. Anyway.
It was very inconsistent progressive scan on GameCube.
Well, yeah, especially because you had to launch it by holding down the B button. It was weird and stupid. Anyway, so into the game. So what you do is it's pretty straightforward. The game gives you effectively no tutorial except to clap because it's not immediately apparent that you might be able to do that if you've never used the bongo before. And basically, that's just an on-screen of somebody clapping. So to move right, you hit the right bongo. To move left, you hit the left bongo. To jump, you hit both bongos. And then for DK to do various action sequences, you clap. That may be collect bananas all around him with his magical tie, which is part of the DK canon. Or for him to attack enemies or to release a shockwave that is apparently destructive to all things around him. It's really simple game, control-wise. I mean, I blitzed through the first, I want to say, 6 or 7 levels basically in just a matter of a couple hours. I mean, it's really fast. And, I mean, control-wise, it's kind of amazing they could map a 2D platformer to what is essentially 3 buttons. I mean, that's just what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the 2 bongos and then a 3rd button that represents your clapping. And that's pretty much all you've got.
The amount of stuff that you can do is pretty impressive given the very limited inputs, I think.
Yeah. The one place where it sort of becomes an issue is that because there's no consistent methodology to press the bongo, even though you can hold down the bongo's trigger as long as you want, it only registers on the downs.
Mm-hmm.
It means that running, in which DK has to do a lot, he has to build up speed, requires you to basically just hammer one bongo over and over again as fast as you can. Until he reaches max speed, which can be somewhat of an exhausting experience.
How much force are you using? Because
Not much. The
bongos are pretty sensitive. You really don't have to. You can kind of just, you know, kind of what's the word? Like kind of waver your hand over it, you know, and just kind of very lightly tap it without having to move your arms up and down very much.
No, I mean, I'm not hammering it on it like I'm in a room full of lit patchouli. I'm just kind of. I mean, I'm tapping it, but I mean it. It's a very un-game feeling. It's not something that you're conditioned to do in gaming, just to move, to have to keep hitting the button over and over again.
Yeah, maybe. Right. Well, back in like the Atari 2600 days, yeah.
Well, no, even then.
But all you had
was
a joystick and a button.
You just tilted the joystick.
I would compare it to like almost like feathering a jet in a Solar Jetman or a game like that, or a Moonlander where, you know, you have some kind of rocket and you don't want to just, and even like the Donkey Kong Country games where you had the rocket, the rocket barrel, you don't just hold it down all the time. You kind of push it on and off depending on, you know, how you want to control your momentum. So it's different, but it's not unprecedented.
No, but it's in that 2D platform.
You could also compare it to just swimming in any 2D Mario game. You have to keep pushing the button in order to keep moving forward.
Yeah. It's just – it takes getting used to it.
Also, speaking of pushing buttons. I mean, when I got the game, I had roommates who found it endlessly amusing at first when I was just like tapping the bongos to play this game. But then eventually, I learned a trick, and it's that there is a button underneath, you know, the skin of the bongos. So you can just press it.
You can feel it.
You just press them.
Yeah, but you have to, I mean, you can't just hold it down. It only registers one press.
You have to press it constantly, but you could leave your fingers on the skin of the drum and just like...
That's basically what I'm doing. It's just getting used to the act of having to just keep doing that.
And instead of clapping, you can just like tap lightly the sides of the bongo.
Oh, okay. So the clapping's actually kind of annoying because it doesn't always register right.
Right.
But there are stages in the game where you're like rocketing around. Those are the most fun, but they require the most clapping usually too. So like, and then afterwards you're like, this sucks, my hands hurt. I thought the bosses were actually one of the more interesting parts of the game, because a lot of times they're really simple puzzle bosses where, you know, they throw something at you, you have to figure out the pattern to chuck it back at their heads. But a lot of times what that ends up meaning is you knock them down and then you just pound on the bongos as fast as you can to just devastate them with punches. I mean, to me, the game itself isn't very challenging. It feels like it's more of a score attack game than anything else.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. To open up the later levels, you have to have a certain number of the bananas. So it is a score attack game, but it's a game that encourages you to learn how to get better scores. Yep. And learn really is the operating word there. It's not just building up skill. It's understanding how the stages are put together and where the kind of different routes are that allow you to keep a combo going. And they're very meticulously laid out. And so as you play more of the game, it encourages you to go back to the earlier levels and play them. And when you do, you will use your newfound, you know, your experience of having played the later stuff and have learning new skills. You'll go back and you'll see those early levels in a totally different way. And you will play through them in completely different ways that will get you just orders of magnitude better scores. So it's not like it's score attack to me always conjures up this image of like playing a vertical shoot 'em up where you play through the same level 100 times, it feels like, and you just kind of slowly memorize certain patterns, or you get your twitch reactions a little bit better every time, and very slowly your scores kind of go upward and upward as you master the game. And I think this game it's a combo based game, but most of the fun of the game is learning how to build those combos, and it's not something that is tedious, in my opinion.
Yeah, but there's kind of a finite number of points that you can get, though. Like, there is one optimal route that eventually you learn.
Right.
Right. I mean,
this would not be a great candidate for, like, online leaderboards, because there is essentially a perfect way to play through the level, and it is possible to play it that way. But learning how to play it more closer and closer to that perfect run is the joy of the game.
I mean, that's the same reason they had to have things like the dance in Runner 2, because otherwise there would be an optimum score.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it would be relatively easy to achieve.
In the BitTrip Complete, the package for Wii that was on a disc, apparently that was a problem, is that they put leaderboards in the game, but because most of those mini games, the BitTrip games, were designed so that there was essentially a perfect way to play through the level. And the other thing is, there's not a huge gap between playing it just well enough to get by and playing it absolutely perfectly.
Right.
Those games are so brutal. If you miss more than 3 or 4 things, you're going to die anyway.
Right.
So essentially, if you beat the level, you already have a really high score. And so there was almost no way to differentiate the players. And Runner 2, it handles that in a lot of different ways.
So, but to the point of the bongos, I mean, how many stages do you... I'm in the second set of stages.
There's like four sets of stages?
Oh, in terms of just the individual levels, I'd say there's in the range of like 30.
Yeah.
There's a lot of secret ones that you can unlock by getting good scores and getting farther in the game.
Okay, because like I've cleared... I'm almost through the K-Barrel set of stages, which I think is 4 each. And each one has 3 levels in it. It's weird. It's a weird level system.
Yeah, but the game is bigger than you think it is at first.
Okay, because like so far, I've either gotten silver and gold on everything. So
there's also like platinum and double platinum and diamond, I think. Yeah, you can get some ridiculous.
But he runs out of banana space because he apparently
it blasts through the end.
Oh my god! Yeah. It's such a weird game. It kind of feels like it. I mean, it feels like somebody in Nintendo's prototyping office was just like, what can we do with this stupid thing? Well, let's make a platformer out of it. I'm like, well, it's already got Donkey Kong theme, so I better have Donkey Kong in it. It's such like a lunchroom dare conversation that turned into a game.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can almost hear the conversation going on between the two game designers. They're like, well, what if we put, and you jumped by hitting them at the same time.
Well, I'm really curious, James, based on your still fairly early impressions of the game, because it's probably about a 10 or 15 hour game right. to see most of the content. You know, this was the first game made by EAD Tokyo, who went on to do yes. Mario Galaxy and then eventually Mario 3D Land. I'm curious if you have noticed any similarities.
Everything's really fucking shiny. I've noticed
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And that is a Mario Galaxy trademark. All of the bosses in Donkey Konga Donkey Kong Jungle Beat are really glossy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they just got laminated. A lot of the boss structure, it's not the same, obviously, because Mario is a 3D game, it's a 2D game, but it's a lot of the hit enemies, target back to him, and then pound on him for a few minutes, then go back.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is sort of endemic to Nintendo games as a whole, but it's very, very prevalent in the Galaxy games.
Well, in this game, one thing they do is there's a lot of volleying. So yes. there's a lot of the whole, you know, Zelda Ganon type battle where the enemy throws something at you and you have to hit it back at him, and then they hit it back, and you finally do it enough times that they miss, and right. and you finally have a chance to go up and beat on them, and that is used a lot in Jungle Beat, and they reprise it quite a few times in the Galaxy games as well.
Yep. Yeah. Suddenly tennis.
Yeah.
That's right.
What's weird is like you're having electric coconuts shot at you, which is an odd experience in and of itself. I don't know. I really liked the, was it a rhino? I think it was a rhino. No, it was an ox. I really liked the ox stage, with the exception of the fact you're just having to destroy your hands playing the bongo. But like, I've only done it twice, and I was kind of surprised they haven't dropped that in more. In place, or in lieu of a regular level, having you ride this deranged, glossy oxen through what is an absolute pandemonium of bananas and jumps. I really enjoyed that level and thought, that could have been more of the game so far. Because, I mean, there was a level where you're controlling a bird and it's kind of a vertical exploration. There's some Donkey Kong Country levels like this. And it's just mm-hmm. not that fun. I mean, it's just like, all right, tap left to make the bird go left, tap right to make the bird go left.
But the ox level that you refer to is really kind of a riff on the minecart thing.
It is.
From Donkey Kong Country, which is one of the great innovations of the entire Donkey Kong Country franchise, is that whole minecart level. It's a kind of platforming level that I don't think really existed before then and is still copied by lots of games
it is a take on it, but I just yeah. happen to enjoy that level probably more than I enjoy the minecart levels.
I'm pretty sure there is more than one of those.
There's two I've seen so far.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. One of them was short. The other one was like the whole level.
Yeah.
Which was kind of exciting in and of itself. It can you die in this game? I haven't really run into a situation where I feel like my life is in peril. I know when you get hit, you lose bananas. If you get to zero, you die.
I don't remember. I think that's – it's not – I mean, probably it is possible, but that's not really the point. You want to avoid getting hit because it
right.
ends your
you
combo.
You lose bananas. Yeah.
Well, yeah, more importantly, it ends your combo, which is losing five bananas is totally beside the point once you're playing at a higher level. It's that the goal, which is very hard to do, but the goal is to start a combo at the beginning of the level and take it all the way to the end. And that is very hard to do, but in order to do it, you have to observe certain things about the level, and you also have to find certain secrets, like secret features that are built in the level design that allow you to bridge one piece of the combo to another in a different part of the level. And finding that stuff is really exciting.
What do
you can get astronomical scores.
What do the flower petally things do?
They fling you upward?
No. There's these little petals that float in the air you collect, and it fills up like a flower gauge. And I can't figure out what it does. I get it, and the game blinks it, and then it goes away. And I'm like, what just happened?
I can't remember.
because the game never really explains what's going on. It just sort of – it's relatively – there's these little between-level tutorials, but
– yeah, the videos. So
they're mostly like, get bananas. Bananas.
No. You need to watch those more closely, because I thought that – see, I played this game in Japanese. I had the King of Kings version from Japan.
What is that version?
It's the Japanese version on the box. It said Donkey Kong, he's the King of Kings.
It's the Jesus nice. Version.
It's one of the reasons I imported it, because I thought it was so funny.
Oh, Lord.
And so I didn't have any English, you know, describing how to play the game. So the videos were incredibly valuable. And they really do teach you the correct way to play the game. And the thing is, they keep showing you these videos all the way up to the end of the game. And as you get deeper and deeper, they show more and more advanced skills. And so towards the end of the game, if you really pay attention and understand what the videos are trying to convey, they will teach you things about either about the level design that you just did or about some skill, some way to bridge a combo that can be absolutely game changing. And then you can take that knowledge and go back to the beginning and play these games in a completely different way than you did before. So the videos, do not skip them and do not take them lightly. They're very, very critical. They're essentially like, they're almost like the, you know, the Mario Brothers Super Play videos that Nintendo's been putting out, in that by watching them, you can learn to play the game in a totally different way.
I'm already the best at all games, so it's fine. I'm good. I am the king of games. It's fine. Yeah.
James Jones, he is the king of kings.
Well, I hope you're going to stick with it, because
that's terrifying for everybody involved, John, and heretical.
I don't know. You can give and you can take. I mean, you know, you have, you know what I mean? Really, every podcast, week to week, you give and you take.
That's what it feels like sometimes, John. And a lot of times it feels like taking.
James, give it, and then James, take it away.
Just a quick check, Guillaume. I know you're a fan of this, being a huge 2D platformer guy like me. But John, I'm sure that you own the bongos, but have you actually played this game?
No, this has to be a new entry onto my Hall of Shame, because literally, I have this game in the box, bongos and everything. I mean, basically, I bought this game, never played it. It's sitting.
Can you send it to me? Because I foolishly sold mine.
That's the thing. Is it still sealed?
It's not sealed. I opened it to check it out, right? But that's
it's not
thing.
Worth anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't really. Think it's really worth anything. But that's the thing, though. I always wanted it because it was so cool.
I was just going to say, if it's still sealed, just put it in a vacuum container and wait.
But that's
30
the thing.
Years.
I mean, I know exactly where it is. I know what bin it's in. It's sitting in there with my GameCube. It's sitting pretty much right next to my GameCube, which is boxed up right now and like sitting in a closet. But.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll say this to you and every Nintendo fan, because this is a very underplayed game, from a very much beloved developer, from a first party Nintendo release. It's a game, and it does require the bongos. They're not optional. And the Wii version is total bullshit. Don't even go there. Yeah. 'Cause you have to play it by like bouncing the remote and nunchuck up and down. It's just the worst idea imaginable.
Well, that always works, though. I mean, there's never been a Wii game where that didn't work successfully.
Yeah, so... No, I thought I'd played just controlling using the stick. I'm fairly sure about this.
Even then, playing this game with a joystick would be kind of missing the point.
Yeah.
To a large extent, because the whole point of the game is you do have to play it rhythmically, and the fact that you're playing it with these drums reinforces that idea, and it helps you understand the rhythms that the levels are based on so that you can play better. So playing it with joystick and buttons would not be a good alternative, in my opinion. But anyway, I just want to make the point. If you're a Nintendo fan, if you love Mario games, if you love Mario Galaxy, if you love 2D platformers, you really have to play Jungle Beat at some point. It is just an absolute gem. It is my number one most overlooked, most wonderful GameCube games. So I'm glad that James is playing it. John, I hope you will dig it up sometime soon and check it out, because I know you'll love it.
Yeah.
It is a game that, in my opinion, it takes a couple hours for everything to start clicking, because the game doesn't tell you up front really what the point is and how to properly play it. Again, it kind of reveals it little by little in these tutorial videos throughout the entire game. But once you start to finally get the hang of it, there's nothing else like it. And it's just an absolutely wonderful game. So John, why don't you follow up next?
All right. Well, I picked up, Castlevania on 3DS eShop.
The original Castlevania.
The original Castlevania. Yeah, there was a little bit of,
Oh, here we go. No, everybody put your John Lindemann's about to go into complete and utter insanity mode hats on.
No, there'll be none of that. None of that tonight.
Trolling will now commence.
Well, see, okay, this purchase was sort of spurred by our own Zach Miller, who wrote a review, of this
quote unquote review,
a quote unquote review, of this
5,000 word review.
Yeah, and he was quite critical of it. And so, you know, I mean, this is one of my favorite games. I mean, I have a long history with this game. This, I think, was the actually the first game. I think I bought this game with my NES when I bought it back, I think, in 87. So I still have this game. I still have it boxed, everything. Like, this is, like, one of my favorite games of all time by far. Now, I mean, he criticized it from the standpoint, and I can see it, this is very valid to me. He felt that it was extremely, extremely hard and really unforgiving. And in a lot of ways it is. You have to play it a certain way. And to me, it has a lot of the hallmarks of, an NES game kind of making things cheap to make things harder.
So for like Ghosts and Goblins?
Like Ghosts and Goblins.
No, Ghosts and Goblins is Super Ghosts and Ghosts.
I think they're very similar.
They are very similar. They're very similar because, you know.
If you're bad at games, sure they are. Ghosts and Goblins is saintly.
Yeah, I mean.
But Ghosts and Goblins has some randomness to it, and I don't think that Castlevania has as much.
Well, that's the thing. Castlevania, I feel, I was playing it today, and I was trying to think of how you can kind of encapsulate its play style, without being completely just sarcastic about it. You almost have to play it like on a grid. You have to really, like, where you put your character, you have to kind of, you can't, even though it's a platformer, you can't feel entitled to go around the screen and pick up everything, because there are pretty much, they'll put like the candlesticks that you have to whip to get hearts and stuff like that. They put those all over the place. But I feel like some people come into the game and say, okay, well, those candlesticks are there, and I have to get all of them. But really, you shouldn't, because that will burn you.
That's a good way to get killed.
It's a good way to get killed, but what'll happen is you will jump to a platform, and a monster will float by, but all the monsters typically, like the floating heads and stuff like that, they all float by in predictable patterns. The question is how you react to them and how you play within those patterns, right? So what happens is you'll see a candlestick, hey, I have to get that. You hop to a platform, and you kind of get to the wrong place, and then you get hit by something and get knocked off. And of course, the way this game works is whenever you get hit, there's a knockback mechanism. So you had better hope that you're getting knocked back onto a platform. Otherwise, you're dead, right? And that can be very aggravating. But I feel like
hope is the right word.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. But
it's kind of hard to plan.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, you kind of have
to. It is possible.
Yeah. That's the thing. You really have to play by the game's rules. I feel like there's rules in place. There's not a lot of room for just kind of winging it. It really lends itself to, you know, to watching for specific patterns, very, very specific patterns, and then going through. I mean, you could easily speed run this game if you kind of knew where everything appeared. And, you know, you have a lot of, you know, you scroll to the left and then scroll to the right again, and the monster reappears. You have a lot of stuff like that.
So you say speed run, but it would look kind of slow.
Yeah,
if
it would look kind of slow.
Speed run Castlevania,
but yeah. So
they just wouldn't die.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the reason, like, I feel like me liking this game as much as I do, it explains a lot. You know, why I like Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Why
Monster
I like
Hunter.
Why I like that's exactly where I was going. Monster Hunter, where you have a sword or whatever that is just extremely unwieldy, and you have to adapt the way the weapon works to whatever you happen to be doing.
It's animation priority, which Castlevania has been doing from the very first game, just like you said.
Yep. It's a lot of timing involved. And you have to look at what's going on and say, how can what I'm doing work into that rather than just charging in there and trying to do whatever.
So basically you're saying the game is bad, and if you don't accept its badness, you're bad.
Well, hang on now. Now, I know if Greg were here, and, you know, Greg Leahy, our former editor and very good friend, is a massive fan of the Castlevania series. Mm-hmm. And what he would say is, even if you don't like the mechanics, the reason that Castlevania was popular in its day, and the reason a lot of people put up with all this bullshit about how hard it is and about how unforgiving the controls and the enemy placement and the physics are, is that the atmosphere was so cool.
Yeah.
And even though the graphics may not even be all that impressive, even in their own time, the setting of being in this castle full of all the horror monsters from every horror movie from the 30s and 40s and 50s, all piled in together, and the awesome music, which is just not like anything else you ever heard on the NES. I mean, those things are the reason that you would play this, because it would capture your imagination. I wonder if that's the case for you, John.
It is. It's very, it's extremely, at the time when it came out, it was extremely unique. I mean, at that time, I was a huge fan of, you know, even growing up as a kid, I was a huge fan of, you know, monster movies and Godzilla and Frankenstein and all that kind of stuff. And this game came out and I was like, wow, that's really cool. You know, you can fight Frankenstein and the Grim Reaper, Dracula, all that kind of stuff. And it was presented in sort of, in that sort of monster movie, horror movie kind of, you know, it was just presented that way. Like, you know, at the very start, the title screen has kind of the film. It looks like a piece of film that's overlaid on the screen. It's very,
and
very
it's
cool.
It's told in like in a serious way. I mean, given the capabilities of the system, but it's not jokey. It's not full of goofy looking monsters, and it's never winking at you or laughing at you.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a kid's game. It feels like it takes itself seriously enough that you can be legitimately scared by it if you have a really active imagination.
Yep, and I mean, it's the feeling of this game really differs a lot from Symphony of the Night and all that kind of stuff, because that sort of went into more of the gothic kind of you know, themes.
I like my leggings on my heroes, thank you very much.
But yeah, but the first one is very much rooted in that kind of, you know, horror movie, early like monster movie culture.
Campy?
Yeah.
Would you go so
I would say campy. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, just watch the credits at the end and the way that
it in blood, do that. I'm going to smash my computer if they write it in blood.
No, but they're just like plays on words, and you know, will be someone will have goal in his name or whatever.
Is that because they weren't translating them back then? They were just making up names for the Japanese people?
Probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was typical back in the early NES days.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still, they didn't always have like movie monsters in the credits. Mm-hmm. Not every Super Nintendo game, not every Nintendo game, you know.
Oh, no, it still comes from the office of fuck your hard work.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, there were other things at the time too. Like, I liked how there was, you had a lot of hidden stuff, especially stuff that you didn't see in platformers specifically. In platformers, you know, the fact that you can whip around and kind of find hidden items was very new at the time. Especially, you know, for an action game, you never really saw that. It was just sort of like, you know, hop from platform to platform, avoid the enemies, blah, blah, blah. There wasn't really any reason to explore any of the environments. But Castlevania introduced the fact of, you know, like sort of like almost like a Metroid, Super Metroid kind of thing where you could, you know, if you just walked over here, this area that you didn't have to go to do anything, if you just, instead of going up the stairs where you normally would go, just walk past them and walk over to this wall and start hammering on it and see if something, you know, see if something falls out of it, like, you know, like a chicken or whatever, you know, some power up.
Some wall chicken.
Yeah, some delicious, delicious wall chicken.
See, John, it's interesting you bring up that particular thing, the idea of like finding hidden items, like just kind of scattered through the environment like that, because I don't know that Castlevania invented it, but I do think it was a really important fad or like new design paradigm around that time, like around 1986, 87, 88.
Yeah.
Because Metroid definitely came after this, but before that you had Super Mario Brothers, which was very innovative in that way. You know, you've got these bricks all over the world, and any one of them might have
bricks.
Yeah, invisible light. Even in the first level, there's that invisible one-up block.
Yep.
So you've got that stuff, and it encourages people to not just take on the enemies or try to get to the end as fast as possible, but to actually explore the world they're given. Mm-hmm. And it's really when you first started thinking of these levels as being worlds. Whereas in arcade games, they're really just levels. It's really just kind of it's like an obstacle course, and the goal is to just get through it intact. And these games started introducing this idea of that there might be things hidden around, and it's worth your time to go off the beaten path just a little bit, you know, judiciously, and look for places where you think there might be something.
Yeah.
But then the frustrating part when people go back now and they play these really older games is that it feels like a lot of times there aren't really any clues as to where these things are hidden. It feels really arbitrary.
Yeah.
Whereas as the design, you know, skills improved over the years, and as video games matured, the designers started to figure out ways to kind of give you hints and try to pull your attention in certain ways. If you're just observant enough, they would find ways to let you in on the fact that there might be something over there.
Yeah, I mean, with Castlevania, it's very much rooted in arcades. You know, the game being as difficult as possible to kind of, you know, elongate the experience. So a lot of these power-ups, they were meant to help you performance-wise, I guess you could say. They weren't really meant to be sort of rewards in terms of I don't know, they're power-ups, but they were sort of like it for the more experienced players, I guess, that wanted to get through the game more quickly. It's not something that, in other words, the focus was not on exploring, even though you got rewards for exploring. That was really not the whole drive of it. Whereas with something like Super Mario Brothers, exploring was kind of the deal, right?
Yeah.
Like you were more overtly rewarded for exploring. So, you know, you would find a warp zone or something like that.
Well, and even in Mario, just look, even if all you find is a hidden coin block, those coins build towards extra lives that are useful to help you survive the rest of the game. Whereas in Castlevania, a lot of times, I mean, the wall chickens are actually very rare.
Yeah.
And usually when you find something secret, it's just a bag of money and all it does is increase your score. It's not useful in any way.
You do earn the lives though, when you get a high enough score.
Yeah. Yep, you do. So, but again, that's very, very arcadey. You get a certain score, you get free lives. So, yeah. Yep.
Right. I mean, it's a lot of games from that era, you can just see, you know, the fingerprints of arcade game designers all over them.
Yeah. Gradius. Games like that. I mean,
a lot of the side scrolling action games were that way. And I mean, Konami is a creature of its era.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it still is. But that particular game is just has that same kind of, I'm just going to be really hard, and sometimes it's going to be really hard just because I hate you.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to live with it. I'm just being an ass right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting game because I think more than anything, it's sort of a time capsule of a time period when that kind of arcade mindset was really prevalent in console game design. And it kind of shows you, if you look at the series overall, it shows you sort of how much that the approach has changed from making games as hard as possible to that kind of quarter munching mentality to sort of fleshing out the experience, maybe making it a bit easier, but focusing, giving the player more options. And it just seems, I mean, you can go straight from Castlevania to Symphony of the Night. And that's sort of really that entire development along the franchise timeline. Really, it really almost points to a bigger trend in gaming overall. So
now that we've discussed Castlevania ad nauseum, back to the topic at hand that started us on this particular conversation, which was a review that spurned you to buy the game.
Yes.
I'm not going to sit here and disparage reviews. It's unbecoming.
It's un-American.
It's pretty
Canadian.
American.
Why do you hate freedom?
My point is more that it raises the difficult question of how do you evaluate a game like this? Because ultimately, it's very easy to find flaws in these older games because they are deeply flawed. But it's,
I don't know, I disagree. You can't
really?
say something just because something is different. I don't think that automatically
I'm not saying
it's flawed.
It's different. I'm saying because in many ways, it is the most basal form of a gameplay style. So it's very difficult.
I don't know. There's a lot of NES games that would fall into the flawed category if you use that criteria. Ninja Gaiden, all those kinds of games. Mega Man,
a lot of
revered games.
No, I know. That's my point. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's very difficult to evaluate these games in a modern context if you're, you know, 30 years divorced or never lived in that context.
Well, I challenge your premise. I think it depends on what are your objectives when you're criticizing one of these old games. Because I would say it's certainly not fruitless. I think we do it every couple of months here on Retroactive. So, I think we have really fascinating conversations. I think if your goal is to go back to a game that's 20 or 25 years old and review it as if you were reviewing a modern game and give it a score and talk about the graphics and talk about the audio in the kinds of ways that you would critique a modern game, that's really, number one, probably difficult to do. And number two, probably not very useful to people.
No, and that's my point.
It's the reason that we don't do virtual console reviews. We sort of do now with the whole review mini thing, but for a long time we just did recommendations. And it was basically like, yo, check this game out. It's really interesting. And you can have as many caveats to that as you want to, but it might still be recommended because it has historical significance or because there's nothing else quite like it or because it just looks awesome, even if it doesn't play well or vice versa. But trying to score it and look at it from all these different categories, you can argue that's not even a good idea with modern games, but it's definitely not a good idea with a game that is that far removed from, you know, the modern context. And I don't think you should directly compare Castlevania to, you know, Lego City Undercover. I don't think that's useful. And trying to use exactly the same system, trying to use the same formalized system to do that is, to me, a bad idea.
I'm just speaking in the terms of the perspective of where, you know, this whole conversation came from. How it got to the point where John was so motivated to buy a game that he already owns just from the ire he internalized at the text presented to him. It is an unenviable and perhaps undesirable position to find yourself in, to have to review a game like this. And,
I agree with that. If you've been assigned it. But I would also say the result that we have here, which is that John has gone back and bought and played and now discussed this game, is kind of the point of doing this kind of coverage, like the review that Zach wrote, which is that it's supposed to either make you check out a game that you never played before, or even if you have, to make you think about it and remember your experiences and want to go back and either relive or even re-examine those experiences. So it's useful in that way.
But that was the exact antithesis of his position, is that you should not go do this. So it's
No, I think that Zach ended saying, you know, you should check it out and make up your own mind.
This is my review, unless you disagree.
The comments thread was very interesting because you pretty much had people that fell on both sides. You had people that were like, you know, Zach's right. This game is crap and it's so hard to play and it's just, you know, it just makes itself much harder than it needs to be. And then you had people that are like, this is an absolute classic. I don't know what you're talking about. So it was just very interesting to see kind of people either on one end or the other of the spectrum, really.
In some ways, this is why the format of Retroactive works really well when it's a game none of us have played or haven't played much, because we're all sort of in this together, just trying to contextualize what we're experiencing, but also trying to frame it within the confines of what gaming was when this game came out.
And you also I agree with you, James, and I think one of the cool things is when we play a game that we haven't played before that we're not familiar with, like, say, Ease Book 1 and 2, which none of us had really played that much of before, there's no one who's on the defensive. There's no one who's trying to rationalize their nostalgia for this game through whatever, you know, valid or invalid arguments. It's more like,
John,
look, we can all say that X, Y, and Z parts of this game are bullshit, but we're going to plow through it anyway because we're all in this together and we're trying to experience it and learn about it together. And everyone has that kind of open mind, you know? And then you've got games like Mega Man 3 that all four of us have already played. Now we're going to go play through it again. And
I think that's going to be a weirder experience.
It is going to be weird. Yeah.
I mean, Ease is the weirdest one.
I haven't played Mega Man 3 in 20 years. Probably.
Yeah, I haven't played forever.
I haven't played Mega Man 3 in 20 months. it was kind of, to give the exact opposite example, when it's one person who's played a game to death and nobody else has played it, you get a very different vibe. And I think writing about a game that you've experienced on your own, that is alien to you and from a different era, it can be difficult to contextualize on your own.
Yeah.
I think the format we have works out really well. Even when we're dealing with something like Ogre Battle, where one person, myself, basically knew how to make that game break itself.
I felt like that was like going to school. That was like going to Ogre Battle school.
It was really weird. Like, I went back and listened to that episode. It's a really strange set of episodes.
Yeah.
Like, it's got a weird vibe to it. But when we go and listen to the East episodes, it's kind of like an AA meeting. I mean, there are points where we're all just like, I don't know how I'm going to go on. This is just too bizarre. This is just weird, crazy town. And we're sort of commiserating and relishing the same things. It's it's hard when you've got a nostalgia tie-in, yeah, and then somebody who doesn't have that, you know, to them the bullshit just jumps right out.
Well, and that's the thing, they don't have any. They don't have any drive to push through it. They're just like, there's better things I could be doing than this. I'm not getting, you know, their experience isn't as
you shouldn't eat,
get as much out of it.
You shouldn't eat chicken you find in a wall in a castle full of zombies. No, I mean, wall chicken is the bulliest of shit.
Yeah,
but it is a thing that Castlevania invented, and we now have to live
yeah,
with.
Yeah, but see, I can pick up the game and I can play through it, and I'm like, that's kind of bullshitty. But I just keep pushing through it because, you know, for right. me, it's just I'm playing it for old time's sake, right? I'm like, oh, I remember
well,
this. I remember this music. I remember this
resistance.
Area, these enemies. I right. remember that whole thing, you know, so it's fun yeah. for me.
But even if you haven't played the game back in the day, I mean, it's still worthwhile to discover it now if you're a fan of that kind of experience. I mean, I was just motivated to push through it after playing Ninja Gaiden, mm-hmm. Because it was just, you know, like, oh, okay, I finally beat this one game that as a kid I never thought I would ever beat.
Yeah.
Now let's do this with another game that I thought I would never beat.
I think the only motivation you should feel at the success of beating Ninja Gaiden is the urge to go to Japan and kill the guy who made Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, it was fun. Like, it's a fun experience sometimes.
Yep.
And I guess perhaps, like, that's one of the determining factors of whether you're going to like the game or not. I mean, like, if you're like Zach, in a hospital bed eating Jell-O and playing this game, perhaps
this game
I
put
too,
Zach in the hospital is what you're telling me.
Perhaps I too would have like negative, you know, not connotations, but
negative.
Anyway,
yeah,
it would
yeah.
not be
yeah.
conducive
exactly
to a good experience.
No, it's not a therapeutic game. Definitely not.
But when you're really set, you know, to play this game and to beat it, then I think you can really have a good time trying to figure it out and trying to figure out how the controls work and
yeah.
how to make them work for you. So, like, really, that would be my advice to anyone who has been interested in getting into Castlevania but never got around to it for some reason. You know, don't let, you know, some people saying, like, well, it's not really worth it anymore. Like, don't let those people turn you away from the game. You know, personally, I still think it's a worthwhile
experience.
I do
think you need
experience.
To have an internal conversation with yourself, knowing that this game is going to do things that are patently unfair, and you have to be just like,
are they unfair, though? Maybe the first time around, but if you get caught, like, a dozen times by the same trap, I think at some point it's your own fault.
I agree, Guy. It's like Super Ghouls and Ghosts. When you get burned, it's your fault.
It's not really true. I mean, Guillaume is right in that because of the arcade, you know, frame of reference that games like this were designed from, they put in a lot of really cheap things that certainly by the 10th time you should have figured it out by then. But the problem is the first time when you're going into an area for the first time and you have that thrill of seeing all these new things and brand new content, and you're almost completely defenseless because the game will throw things at you from off the edge of the screen that you have no chance.
Okay, but there is one element in there that I think makes all difference in the world. Like, it makes the difference between whether I'm going to beat an NES game or not, and it's infinite continues.
Or on 3DS, you've got the save states.
Yeah.
Well, sure.
It's the same thing, basically.
Still, infinite continues really, really help. Like, I probably will never get through Master Blaster.
Totally agree with you. Mm-hmm. That's the same problem I have. I'm good at that game, but I get to a point and it just, by sheer attrition, I've just died too many times and I just can't keep going anymore. And that's a game I would love to have on 3DS Virtual Console just so I could save state it and then finally beat it. As we move on, and we do need to move on, but I did want to make the point that if you're ever intrigued to go out and try some of the classic Castlevania games, I would certainly recommend doing so, but I feel pretty strongly that Castlevania 3 is the place to start.
I would agree. I would agree.
It's more mature. It's still very difficult and very challenging, and it maintains all of the purity of the things that John talked about with the design of the first Castlevania.
Or you could get Super Castlevania 4 and play it.
It's just not as cheap, and it's more accessible. It's a better game because it was made much later.
Yep.
And if you love Castlevania 3 and you learn to master it, then you can easily go back and play the first one and appreciate what it does as well.
Mm-hmm. Does Castlevania 3 still have infinite continues?
I think so. It does. I believe it does.
Okay, maybe I'm getting confused with Ninja Gaiden. With the third one, they just drop they have finite continues.
Because Ninja Gaiden needed, it was more.
Yeah, that's exactly
that's a huge
it, right?
problem mm-hmm. with the third one.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, since Johnny said his piece, for me it's 4, and get the fuck out. Anything else? Anything?
Before Super Castlevania 4 is a great game. I love that
game.
Yeah.
But Castlevania 4 is also very different from the first three.
It is, and that's why it's a great game.
Or from 1 and 3. 2 is a whole different story.
That's why it's a great game.
All right, so we need to move on. I'm going to be pretty quick with mine because the game itself is pretty quick. I picked up Liberation Maiden because it's half price on the eShop. It's $5 until the end of May.
I think it's pronounced Maiden.
Yeah.
Got to get it proper.
It's a game where you liberate your den from the clutter.
You just
it's
won
a feng
the episode.
Shui simulator.
Doom. Yeah, so anyway, Liberation Maiden, I do recommend it for $5. I think at $10, it's a little more challenging.
It's a hard sell, and I bought that game, and I like that game.
Yeah, it is really short. I mean, the whole game is about an hour, maybe an hour and a half long, and that's not because I rushed through it or anything. It's just, it's a kind of a very finite
length. That's how long
length.
It takes.
It's 4 levels. And the levels are maybe 15 minutes apiece. I had to replay one of them because the game locked up on me and booted me out to the menu. So it took me a little bit longer than it will most people probably, but it's really fun. It's very arcadey. It's not that difficult. There are scoring systems and combo systems that I really don't understand very well. So I think there is replay value if you're into that kind of thing. But for me, it was worth $5 just to play through it and see the goofy story and the cool graphics. And, you know, the controlling the game is fun. I mean, you move around with a circle pad and use the touchscreen and stylus to kind of trace over enemies and pick up homing targets. And then you let go, you lift up off the touchscreen and all your lasers go out there. Or later on, you get a weapon that just holds a laser beam. First, you know, until the energy runs out and you can just kind of drag it over targets or hold it down on them and it'll just kind of burn through them until they die. Either way, they're both, you know, very different and really fun ways to play the game. And if anything, I kind of wish there were more dodging, opportunities, you know, like in Star Fox, which is the closest thing to this, you have the roll. And the barrel roll is easy to abuse, but it's also very important, and it's important to learn when to use it and when it's absolutely required. And Liberation Maiden doesn't really have anything like that. The defensive mechanic is very passive. It's basically stop shooting for a minute and maybe try to move out of the way, but your lateral movement is so slow that it's difficult to move out of the way in a lot of cases. So defensively, not a whole lot going on here, but offensively, it's really fun. You know, Sin and Punishment is another great parallel. It's certainly not as good as Star Fox or Sin and Punishment, but it's similar enough that if you like those games, you'll probably really like Liberation.
It's a hell of a lot funnier, too.
It is pretty funny. Yep. I especially love the little news feeds. Every time you complete an objective, this little news feed will appear towards the top of the screen, and it's easy to miss because the game doesn't pause to let you read it or anything, but it's like a quote from some random citizen who talks about your performance as Office of the President, of High School President of Neo Japan. But the game looks good. It controls well. It's pretty fun. Yeah, for $5, I think it's a steal. So I would recommend that you check it out if you have any interest in that kind of thing.
It's I'm trying to remember, it's all stylus controlled, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other option.
Use a circle pad to move around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's...
So it has that kind of Kid Icarus. It's not the most comfortable thing, but you're not going to be playing it for 6 hours at a time.
No, I find it really uncomfortable to play, so...
Yeah.
Use a stand.
yeah, use the stand.
The stand that you get when you buy the game, it's delivered digitally through 3DS.
I'd be quite interested in like a sequel that was longer and had, you know, some different gameplay ideas and some different levels and Circle Pad Pro support maybe.
Yeah, I have to say that like the sequel, like the visual novel that they've got planned is of no interest whatsoever to me.
It definitely has some different gameplay style.
Hey, to be fair, the world that they've created, the premise of the story of this game is weird and interesting. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, but is there any way that it won't veer into like creepy territory?
I want it to veer into creepy. That's the point. That's what I want.
It's Suda51.
I want this game to turn into like this weird, awkward semi-sexualization of a high school prince or a high school girl slash president slash mecha pilot.
Yep.
Because it would be awesome.
And Liberation Maiden, I think that you can really I don't know. Like, it's just enough of that to be kind of a satire.
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder if it would not become what it's satirizing.
I think with Suda 51, you could go either way.
I want that game to, when I launch it, to be like high school slash president of Japan slash mecha pilot dating simulator. I want this game to be just complete fucking balls to the wall insane. If this game came to the US, I would buy a PS3 to get it because I know it's going to be insane. It would be worth the price of admission just to experience the chaos of what is supposed to be a video game wash over me.
YouTube will have to do.
Yeah.
But I will I'll understand a tiny, tiny bit.
All right. So let's wrap it up with Guillaume's new business.
Yeah. So, last week, right after the recording, I was not ready to go to sleep yet. So I knew I was close to finishing, Etrian Odyssey 4. And so for a couple of hours, I just beat my head against the walls of this last maze, and then found the last boss and finished it off with ease. And, finally I'm done. Done with Etrian Odyssey 4 after 71 hours, according to the...
Congratulations,
the
buddy.
3DS, you earned it. Yeah.
And then you found there's a second quest.
Ah, well, no, I already expected that. Not only is there, like, a new game plus mode, but there is also a sixth dungeon, optional dungeon.
Oh, that is Atlas everywhere.
Now I grew up with RPGs, you know, like I played them on the Game Boy. RPGs on the Game Boy, 20 hours, you know.
Tops.
And then I did play Final Fantasy IV, which was, you know, like, I don't know, 25 hours. Mm-hmm. And Final Fantasy VI, you know, which perhaps is like 40, 45 hours. But my main, like the only, RPG that I owned on Super Nintendo was Chrono Trigger, which is really like, you can be done very quickly in that game. And then with each, new game plus, because I play the game multiple times, it just gets quicker and quicker. So I'm not used to these long ass RPGs that take forever to complete. And I get quite tired of them, honestly. I guess that Etrian Odyssey 4 did a better job at keeping my attention than, I don't know, like Persona 3. But it did, like, there were, like, if you were to chart my enjoyment over time of this game, there would be a lot of peaks and valleys. Because, you know, like, I think the game did a good job at introducing a new gimmick that was interesting, you know, every couple of mazes or so. But then you end up doing the same thing for, you know, an hour or two or three or five. And then, you know, until you hit the next point where they do something different. So I think that the game was mostly, you know, like it would have been better paced if only, you know, these gimmicks, these new ideas came up more quickly or more often. Or if the game overall was just shorter, you know. Yeah. Now, I know that some people really enjoy these long-ass RPGs. I street passed a guy who had reached level 99. He had, like, with all of his characters, he had started over because his current party was not level 99. But I could see his stats. He had killed every monster, had found every treasure chest, had found every item, like 100% everything.
Wow.
It did not tell me how long it took him to do that, but
over 100 hours.
I can,
you think?
Oh, certainly, mm-hmm. Most definitely, and he was like already in the second game. So obviously, these RPGs are made for someone. I don't think that someone is me.
yeah.
But at the same time, I'm really happy that I played it and that I played it to completion. And I, you know, like I don't know, like towards the end, like I was still not quite completely fed up with it. Like I was still really enjoying the game. During the final battle, like my pulse was really really high, you know, like I was just I gotta finish this boss. And you know, once I saw the credits with really beautiful music, and then like the game continues on and they tell me, oh, like remember this locked door? I think that we found the key for it, and you know, go check it out if you want. When I read that, I was kind of tempted, you know, more than I was tempted to finish off Dragon Quest VI.
Do it.
And perhaps, like, just because the game is, you know, I downloaded it, maybe, like, now it's residing permanently on my 3DS. I think there's a chance that I might go back. Not right now, but I might eventually. Because there's still some new stuff to see, so I want to see that new stuff. So, yeah, like, it's, I would recommend it, but I do wish it weren't so fucking long. I would be way more tempted to play through it again if it were shorter.
I hear you, man. But hey, congratulations for finishing that. That's quite a slog, and I'm not saying it was unpleasant all the way through, but really, 70 hours is
that's a lot
impressive.
Of time, yeah. Yeah.
As a consumer of the sorts of long, drawn-out RPGs, I mean, to me, I know there are peaks and valleys, and I can understand why it frustrates people who aren't, you know, that's not their thing. You know, they don't sit there and go, ha, this game's going to be 100 hours. Hell yes. It's sort of a, I think it is. I think it's something you have to kind of build up an immunity to. I mean,
maybe, but how can I build an immunity to it when?
I'm not saying it's anything wrong. I'm just saying it's kind of like, I think if you've been through it, it's sort of an expectation, so you kind of stop noticing them a little bit. But, I mean, to me, those really, really long RPGs, I very rarely go back and replay them, not because I didn't love them, but because I'm good. You know, I really wanted
them so much.
Well, yeah, well,
it's not even that.
So much
it's
time
really,
in their
I
world,
play
right?
I play the RPG to see their world. Yeah. And at that point, I've seen it. You know, I've lived this world. I mean, there's only a handful that I really go back and play more than one more time.
Yeah, but, you know, like, stuff like Chrono Trigger, you just end up falling in love with the characters.
But, you know, I was done with Chrono Trigger after two or three plays. I'm like, you know, it's a great game. I like it, but I've seen its world. I'm set. I understand. I mean, I felt like, you know, really the handful of games I really enjoy are the ones that do almost these, not really enjoy, really enjoy the third or fourth time, are the ones that do these really tight, compact worlds that do lots of character level interaction.
See, I would say Chrono Trigger is exactly that. And that game's 20 hours long and has more variety and heartfelt, you know, character development than most RPGs that are three times longer.
It's not about the length for that, though.
Yeah, the pacing is really, really good, in my opinion. And there's only, like, I don't care that much about 65 million BC or the future. But, you know, like, they're still pretty engaging. And it comes so quickly in the game that you find out what's your ultimate goal. And you see the results of, you know, like, these events that you're supposed to stop. And I don't know, like, there's way more of a good, cohesive story and, you know, well-paced.
But that's not what it's about for me at that point. I know how the story ends now.
It can end very differently depending on what you do in Chrono Trigger.
To an extent, yes.
It can.
But, I mean, it can, yeah. If you go and beat the game at the very beginning, you'll get a very different ending.
No, I mean, for instance, the Black Omen is completely optional, and the game ends, I mean, the final boss and the ending and the whole final 5 hours of the game can be completely different whether or not you take that route. So it's not a trivial thing. It's not like, yo, the last, you know, 2 minutes of the ending cutscene are slightly different.
But that's not my point. My point is it's not the story that I would be going back for in those cases. It doesn't matter if the story has a forking path at the end. To me, what matters when I go back and re-experience an RPG is wanting to be in that world. And in that world isn't the same as experiencing that story. They can be two completely different things.
Yeah. Yeah,
there are RPGs I've played that have pretty lackluster stories, but still manage to build these really awesome worlds with really interesting characters that maybe they don't tell a great story, but themselves are exciting to see and be around.
Xenoblade's a great example of that. The plot of that game is nothing to, you know, write a book about.
There's a lot to write about the end of that game. There is a lot of stuff to write about.
I can say, though, Etrian Odyssey is not a game that I would go back to for its story or its characters. Like, it has basically none.
Yeah.
But the act of discovering and charting these new areas and finding new stuff and finding shortcuts so you can get to some places quicker the next time. And it's pretty addictive, and it's very, very fun. And definitely the game is at its best when you're constantly pushing forward and, you know, discovering. But then there comes a point where you might have to do some grinding, and that's just brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I that's one thing I don't quite get. And Atlas is somewhat more guilty of this than others. Is there doesn't seem to be, we don't seem to have reached that point as designers where they can pace what your level should be very well. Some games have adopted the sort of sliding scale of enemy strength, but sometimes that makes the game just feel like everything I do, it doesn't get any easier.
Yeah, that to me, that does defeat the point of an RPG to some mm-hmm. extent, which is that you're supposed to feel like you're getting better and more powerful as the game goes on. But if the enemy scaled directly with you and there's not really a whole lot of lag, then it's like, what's the point of leveling up if everything else levels up at the same time?
You do gain skills in Atrian Odyssey, and they really make a difference. Okay. And if you plan things right, you do counter the enemy's moves, and you know, like, you know what to do. Like, oh, this enemy is gonna poison all of my party, and poison in this game is really devastating. But if you can figure out how to counteract that, like, you really feel great about it. Then mm-hmm. the combat is very strong in this game. Like, it's not mindless.
That's good. No, for 70 hours, you want a good combat system. So that's
Atlas,
good to hear.
Atlas can build good combat systems. I mean, they do. I mean, right in Historia is the last Atlas game I played for any significant time. It's got friggin' amazing combat systems.
Stellar.
Mm. For some reason, since there is so few Western developers behind the 3DS, I saw the support that Atlas was giving the 3DS, and I was like, you know what? This gen, I'm going to be an Atlas fan.
It's worth
and
it.
I decided like, okay, I'm going to buy their games. I'm going to play them and I'm going to love them. Damn it. But then, you know, I play this and I can't finish it after months, before the next Atlas game comes out. And I'm just, I'm scared.
That's Atlas will do that. They'll put relatively daunting. I mean, there are certain games that Atlas has you have to force yourself to kind of love them. And I don't mean that I really need to like this game, but more like you really have to get back on that wheel and just get through it, because it's gonna take some time to get to what makes that game good.
So I wonder if both James and Guillaume are both gonna end up playing through Shin Megami Tensei 4.
I definitely plan on it.
See, you know, that'd be quite a compare and contrast, you know.
For whatever reason, the Shin Megami Tensei, and I've given it more than a few tries.
But with any of the numbered series? Because the spinoffs are supposed to be very different than the main line.
Yeah,
numbered.
I mean, they still... I'm tempted. I've just had... You know, they just never really... I think the whole... Like I said, it goes back to the whole world. I don't like the world of those games, I think. I think the whole, like, look, you can recruit these demons.
Yeah.
It's sort of... I think it's like, all right.
Have you played
whatever.
A Persona game, though? Because that's a pretty...
I haven't, because I don't think to play them at the moment.
It's a pretty cool world. You know, it's set in a high school. So I've only played maybe 5 hours of Persona 4. It's going to be a long burn for me on the Vita. But, you know, for me, it's like the combat system seems fun and, you know, the whatever. But the main appeal of it is that it is in this high school, and the story and the characters are so totally different than anything in other JRPGs that seems to be the driving appeal. And much of the game is developing the relationships. I mean, Guillaume knows all about it, of course, but that seems to be the appeal from what I've seen so far.
And the characters will keep you playing the game for a long, long time. Perhaps like towards after 50 hours, you might want to see it end.
Yeah.
But yeah, like definitely. And the combat system is fast and pretty fun. Yeah. And,
I'm all aboard for the next high school dating simulator / combat game. So we'll get on
it
that.
It works better than you think.
But you're kind of holding out for Soccer Wars 10 or whatever.
First off, they're not high schoolers. They are military experienced soldiers.
Okay.
They have a serious job on their hands. They're keeping you safe.
See, in Valkyria Chronicles, there are soldiers and high schoolers at the same time.
Only the second one.
I would totally buy another Sokka Wars game because it's amazing. It's so ridiculous and beautiful and amazing.
All right, so that's going to wrap up our new business this week. We're going to take a quick break and come back with your listener mail and plenty of talk about Mr. Iwata's new role in the company.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we got a blog called One More Shot by JP Corbrin. For some reason, we made a person who self-identifies as a troll in his own postings on the as a community manager. Today, he's gloating about trolling Link to the Past. However, he's had a change of tune with his recently announced sequel. He's giving Link to the Past another chance. Except, yeah, expect more ham-fisted trolling. We also have a feature called Going the Distance, Gaijin Games on Runner 2, Sequels and Worst Name for Japan by Tyler Olu. We briskly run through an interview with Mike Roush of Gaijin Games on the future and past of the Runner franchise.
That's a good interview.
We have a blog by Neil Ronahan and Nicholas Bray called Photos of the CirclePad Pro XL. Baby, you know bigger is better, and now you can pump up that 3DS XL with some extra action on the side. Come see the scale of the 3DS XL plus CirclePad. As an owner of a CirclePad Pro, I can only imagine how incredibly cumbersome
impressive,
the CirclePad Pro XL must be.
How impressive it is in its girth.
All right, and we have a review of Witch's Cat for 3DS by Patrick Barnett. Alicia is a witch. She can turn into a cat. The name of the game is Witch's Cat, Possessive Case. I must assume Alicia owns herself, or this is about to get awkward. Unrelated, Witch's Cat is a puzzle game. It's pretty average.
Way to spoil it. We have a review revisit. Paper Mario Sticker Star on 3DS. Sticker Star is a contentious game. The entire staff gets to weigh in on Paper Mario. They cover it with 7 stickers, which is also the ex post facto number given to Mario Kart on 3DS. Conspiracy, as it's written here. We have a review. The Amazing Spider-Man Ultimate Edition for Wii U by Zach Miller. It has come. The subtitled Wii U games with U names. Uninspired naming aside, web swinging has never been so good on Wii U. Wait.
Yeah, Zach seems to like that game more than just about anybody.
Yeah.
I had to figure out a temper.
Arkham Asylum with webs.
Yeah, that's what he called it. So yeah. Very high praise. Maybe that game deserves another look. All right, so we also have a review for LEGO City Undercover, The Chase Begins on 3DS by Curtis Bonds. It's his first review for the site. Sometimes stuff under the covers needs to stay there. The 3DS Undercover isn't quite that bad, but unless you need to know everything about Chase McCain, it could probably stay there.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, too bad. And we also have an editorial, Hyrule Historia, A Timeline for the Trash. By Justin Baroom. Ever want to read 1,100 words on how Nintendo messed up their own timeline? Want to know how one superfan can fix the plot holes? Justin provides.
Yeah, it's not so much a timeline as it is sort of a time guide.
It's not how you program your TV.
That sounds like a pretty good slew of content over there. So as always, we highly recommend that you head over to NintendoWorldReport.com to check all of this stuff out. Oh, and also, I forgot to mention last week, a brand new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition featuring our friend Michael T.Y.P. Cole and Neil Ronahan. Always one of the best podcasts on the internet. Definitely check that out as well. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail, and with the big news this morning,
me versus
about Mr. Iwata, which we will go into in depth here very, very soon. I put out a call and said, "Hey, if you'd like us to talk about this, maybe you want to send in an email about it," and people did. And so we're going to start off with the one, kind of the most succinct one that we got on this topic. But again, the address as always is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we appreciate everybody who writes in every week. And, James is going to read the first letter this time.
I'm going to read Sean's letter because Sean writes, "With recent announcements that Iwata will be stepping into the role of NOA CEO, I have been trying to gauge the impact. Being cautiously optimistic, I feel that a unified Nintendo may increase our chances of seeing more previously unavailable Japanese games in the future, as well as the possibility of Nintendo being more active publishing Western games. On the flip, there is the chance that Iwata just simply brings the same severely closed-off Japanese philosophy that NCL seems to have, and we are stuck with the exact same situation we have been. What are the pros and cons can you all see from this change?
Well, it's probably not a bad thing for him to get closer to the Western world, right?
Probably like, but is he? He's probably going to develop a drinking problem and an obsession with reality TV.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's been a little bit of I don't know if I'd call it infighting, but you know, there's been some talk. I've seen I don't know where I read this, but Reggie, there was kind of a slam made at Nintendo of America marketing for something. I don't know. Just bringing this
for
in terribly.
The Wii U launch.
Likely the Wii U launch, but
you mean the fact there were no ads on television for it? That would be a pretty legitimate slam.
Reggie was sort of thrown under the bus, and he actually responded in an interview that he kind of heard the statement made and kind of cringed at it. And I think that kind of speaks to, I feel like there's kind of been a growing rift around Wii U. Just kind of from the outside looking in, sort of Nintendo of America probably doesn't feel like it's receiving the amount of support that it needs. And they also probably feel that Nintendo of Japan, NCL, is sort of out of touch with the American market. So
they are, yeah.
So I feel like this is kind of Iwata kind of having a mandate. I mean, Reggie is going to report directly to Iwata. So there is now no more – there's no more excuse. There's no more middleman, nothing. You know, Kimishima is no longer there.
Who was the CEO before this?
Yeah, who's the CEO before now?
He's not being fired, but you never get fired in Japan.
Yeah,
he's being promoted, which
it's the same as being fired in Japan.
Well, their words, promoted. Now, this might be a Ken Kutaragi moment where, you know, they're kind of changing his title and shoving him off in the corner and say, go over there and quit messing up our company. But he's being promoted from CEO of Nintendo of America to a managing director of NCL in Japan, which tells you kind of where NOA sits in the organization of this company, that you could be at the very, very top position in NOA and then be promoted to a seemingly
director.
Lesser position in the main part of the company.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that does raise the question that may strike directly at the heart of this email is, was Kimishima really doing anything?
Yeah.
I didn't see him in any Nintendo Direct.
I mean, to me, I always assumed, and I think somewhat correctly, that he was just the requisite Japanese face of the American division. That the power was vested with the president of Nintendo of America, which would be Reggie.
I would say the responsibility is vested with the president. The power to sign legal documents and you know, formally sign off on decisions would rely with the CEO, but how much decision making actually gets made by the Japanese CEO of Nintendo of America?
It's not unclear.
Kimishima is the first ever CEO of Nintendo of America, so we don't. I mean, that position was created for him so that Reggie could be promoted to president without taking over the entire branch. So it's never been made clear what exactly Kimishima does. I mean, the role that he had before that, when he was president, he was the second ever president of Nintendo of America after Mr. Arakawa, who was the founding president, who was the nephew of Mr. Yamauchi in
Japan. Keep it in the family.
So Mr. Arakawa had questionable, you know, involvement at a really, you know, critical level. He certainly was involved in the early days, you know, but in terms of how important he was, it's never been very clear what exactly Mr. Arakawa did at Nintendo of America for most of the time there. And it's certainly not been clear whatsoever what Mr. Kimishima does. I'm not even sure I've ever seen a photograph of him.
Yeah, I haven't either.
I mean, there's always a person at Nintendo of America, even before they created this CEO holding chair for the Japanese authority, there was always, like, Lincoln was at NOA alongside Arakawa. I mean, there was always another person there who also was nominally in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, to their credit, even though Nintendo of America is not really an American company, I mean, it's located in America and most of the employees are American, but it's owned by the Japanese branch, and it has virtually no autonomy whatsoever. I mean, they do whatever, you know, NCL in Japan tells them to do. I will say, to their credit, they've always been pretty consistent about employing Americans, even in the major positions like the vice presidents. You know, you had Perrin Kaplan and Beth Llewellyn and George Harrison and Reggie Fils-Aimé and, you know, all these fairly well-known people, who have, you know, Charlie Shibata now and Shibata. Not the same as Shibata in Europe, but they've done well in filling up the positions, and I've always had the feeling that that company is run by Americans to that it does anything. And in other words, within the very limited responsibility that Nintendo of America has, it is run by Americans, but formally, officially, it is run by a Japanese person, and that has always been the case.
That's the thing. Japan signs the check, so I would imagine there is a lot of, hey, we think this is a good idea, but is it going to fly in Japan? Is Kyoto going to be on board with this?
And everything they do has to get signed off by Japan.
Exactly.
We know for a fact that is the case.
Which is huge, because, I mean, especially, you know, Nintendo, over the past couple of years with a lot of the game choices that they've made, the games that they've, you know, really pushed, they seem very Japan-centric. And I think that's one of the problems that they've had now.
Yeah.
Well,
so
what do you mean, though? Like, on the Wii, there were a lot of things that perhaps seem Japan-centric, like, oh, Crazy Japan, a balance board? Get out of here. But then they make it a success.
They haven't exactly embraced any typically Western genres of games, really. They've kind of stuck in their lane.
What you see is, if you look back in the late 80s when Nintendo was becoming a household name for the first time in America, there was this sense that, and this was true of a lot of things in the 80s, including, you know, car manufacturing and a lot of other things. There was a sense that Japan was kind of taking over America. And in a lot of cases, it was sold that way. It was, you know, people, it was like the hot new Japan thing. It was a broadening of appeal of very Japanese things. It was introducing America to Japan culture. It was the, you know, popularity of sushi, among many other things. For the very first time, people were being exposed to all this Japanese culture. And what's interesting is that over the past 30 years of Nintendo of America being a thing, they have not really changed very much. They are still, I mean, you say like the balance board. I mean, of course, it was very successful in America, but that is a very Japanese product. And Nintendo of America's role is to take Japanese things and sell them to Americans. It is not to make American things for Americans.
No.
And that's very different from what you see, for instance, with Sony, because Sony of America has autonomy. They create things that are very American that don't fly at all in Japan, and that's okay. That's their charge is to sell things to Americans and to make things to sell to Americans. Nintendo of America does not do that, and I think it is very much tied to the fact that no American has ever run Nintendo of America. That is still true as of today.
But see, I still don't know how much – I mean, keep in mind that – I mean, so Kimishima's previous – I mean, he was 27 years at a bank, at Sanwa Bank, mostly posted in the U.S., so obviously that's where he got – after that, he was the CFO of the Pokemon Company. I mean, basically, he got shifted in as a result of Yamauchi's retirement and then the shuffling of all the deck chairs that took place.
Arakawa's retirement.
Well, he got brought into... Yeah, I mean, that was the...
Although you could say Arakawa's retirement was forced by Yamauchi's retirement.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was
his uncle was no longer there to, you know, sort of protect him.
It was basically... It's like a year later, too, I think. I mean, it was really fast.
Yeah, pretty close.
So, I mean, before that, I mean... I don't know that he was ever really doing anything besides maybe financial planning. I mean, really, it sounds more like from his job description, his experience, he was more or less acting as a CFO.
Right. Whereas Reggie's experience was as a marketing guy. I mean, he did the Bigfoot pizza campaign for Pizza Hut.
Pizza is the most important marketing campaign ever.
He sold beer. I mean, Reggie was hired as the vice president of marketing.
Right.
And then he was later promoted a few years later to president. And that's when the CEO position was invented for Kimishima. But Reggie's background is in marketing, and it makes sense because that's really all NOA does. As far as I can tell, they have two roles. They choose which games to localize, although I'm not sure how much final say they have in that. It does seem from a lot of interviews with Reggie that he does have a lot of input into which games they do and do not release.
His famous comments on Disaster, which he's not localizing it because it's bad.
Yeah. And I think his track record on that matter is spotty, to say the least. They have brought over a lot more things than they ever had before he came in charge. And I give a lot of credit for making things like Fire Emblem and Advance Wars and, you know, lots of other stuff very popular that in past generations might not have come over at all. But I think there's a lot of other terrible decisions they made on stuff like Xenoblade and Rhythm Heaven and, you know,
Glory of Heracles.
Mother 3.
Yeah, you're saying that game coming over was a terrible decision.
Yeah, yeah. Like, okay. they prioritized that over something else.
Hey, I reviewed that game. It was a game.
I'm sure it definitely happened.
Yeah.
They're all Heracles, every person.
Maybe I'm just associating this decision with Iwata because he's the one who announced it in the Nintendo Direct. Or did he? Like, maybe it was in
a press release.
Shareholder
press
meeting.
Release, yeah.
But, no, but I'm talking about something else. The decision to have Nintendo assist or localize or publish more Western RPGs, Eastern Japanese RPGs in the West.
JARPers.
Like, do you guys think that this was Iwata's decision, or
anything that happens at Nintendo is ultimately Iwata's decision.
Yeah.
Okay. So is that related to the fact that it may not have been his idea,
but ultimately he could have killed it on his desk if he wanted to.
I wouldn't assign too much meaning to who conveys a certain announcement in a given Nintendo Direct any more than I would say you shouldn't assume that whether John or Paul sang the Beatles song means that they're the one who wrote it. I think they wrote them together for the most part, and they chose who to sing it based on what key it was in for the, you know. So I wouldn't put too much meaning
My point is more like it's very likely, right, that it's ultimately Iwata's decision, like this.
Right. I mean,
James is correct. Everything is ultimately Iwata's decision, and that it did not change today.
No, I mean, ultimately, I think this just formalized. I mean, to me, this more or less crystallizes how relatively unimportant the CEO position was at Nintendo of America.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have an absentee CEO.
That's one. So I see three potential meanings of this. Because effectively, you know, the elephant in the room is that Reggie did not get promoted.
Yep.
To this position. So there was a vacancy immediately above him. He's been president for about 5 or 6 years now. He's done a pretty good job overall. You have to say from a financial standpoint, he's been successful, you know, in the same respect that Iwata has been successful over the past decade when you add it all up together with Wii and DS, you know, being so dramatically dominant in the industry that those two guys deserve a lot of credit for that. And the fact that Reggie was not promoted to CEO today and that Iwata took it over basically because just by default, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to go out and find – I wonder how temporary this is really. But to me, there's three ways you can take it, okay? And I would say all these are bad, maybe to different degrees. Number one, like James said, CEO position was really a figurehead and it doesn't matter who fills it. So it's whether Iwata has that title or not, it doesn't really change what he does on a day-to-day basis.
That particular read, the only reason you wouldn't make Reggie president and CEO is you would have to do some corporate deck chair shuffling just to sort of make the positions work again. Yeah. And they didn't want to redo their org chart, essentially.
Well, they could have hired someone from the outside to fill the CEO.
But if the CEO is not doing anything,
Reggie's not Japanese, so
John has the second one. Maybe Reggie wasn't promoted because their shareholders would not stand for a non-Japanese person to be in that role, which, frankly, is racism. And I'm not very happy with that situation at all. If that is the reason, who can say? But again, I will say no American has ever run Nintendo of America, the wholly owned subsidiary of NCL. And I think the fact that, you know, this position opened up and you have a highly qualified person who could have easily been promoted to fill it and wasn't. In fact, they didn't hire anyone to fill it. They just kind of added it on to something that Iwata was already doing. I think it has to open up those questions of, you know, is this a company that cannot stand for a non-Japanese person to fill that the highest ranking position at Nintendo of America?
Well, you know, I don't think
because that's unacceptable ethically to me personally. You know, I think that's really bullshitty. I think it is part of Japanese corporate culture.
Yeah, I don't get it too.
See, I think NOA is the only division that has a CEO though. I know Shibata is the president, and there. He was president of Nintendo of Australia before that.
Mm-hmm.
I think
There used to be a president of Nintendo of Canada, but I'm not sure that position exists.
I think there still
anymore.
Is, yeah. I mean, I do
I'm not
wonder,
sure,
though.
I mean, Nintendo of Canada does exist, but I think they're very
I think they're now vice president of operations for Canada. I think.
Okay, yeah. I think it's kind of a satellite office for Nintendo of America. I think that person would still report to Reggie and or the CEO.
My read is sort of a counter read to the first two put together is that it's the only division with the CEO, so maybe this is just slowly the process of consolidating that position out of existence.
Yeah, maybe so. So just so I can finish my thought, the third possibility here is that Reggie wasn't promoted because they're not very happy with Reggie's performance.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe they're blaming him for things that are out of his control because he's been given a shit sandwich to work with so far with, you know, a console that's confusing to market and has not nearly enough games to make it appealing to people. And, you know, maybe there isn't a good way to market Wii U right now. I'd say I could think of some ways to do it, but, yeah. You know, it's easier said than done.
But also the 3DS was overpriced at launch.
Sure.
Didn't have a lot of games. So.
Which may have been totally out of his hands as well.
But the 3DS now isn't the problem. I mean, it's,
no,
oh,
the 3DS agreed. Is the solution.
Right, yeah, the 3DS is great. Everything.
Yeah,
3DS
I know, but you could still throw that at him and say, it doesn't matter. Your job is to market this shit, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
You could.
And
I think
how successful is he and, you know.
But that's kind of what I've been getting at is the fact that NOA has kind of been thrown under the bus, I think, for a lot of Japan's mistakes. And I also have to wonder if within the company at large in Japan, if NOA, for better or worse, whether or not this is true or not, whether it's NOA is kind of seen as screwing up.
Well, honestly, I mean, I know we say, well, they weren't given much to work with on the Wii U, but I honestly didn't see a single ad in the launch window for the Wii U.
Yeah, I mean, they made those TV ads. I've only ever watched them on YouTube, but
I've
think
never
they're terrible.
Seen them on TV. I mean,
it was unclear if it was a new console. Like that is a very basic
and
problem.
And that's Nintendo of America's sole responsibility, really, is to take this product and make it marketable to Western audience.
You know, Reggie probably like his input was probably taken into account like for the Wii U name, but like it was the ultimate decision was out of his hands. But then like
it's the same name worldwide, so that decision would have to.
Yeah, but once you have the Wii U name, you realize okay, it's very similar to Wii U. You gotta be thinking I have to separate this the most I can from the Wii.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of whatever cards he was dealt, they did not advertise the Wii U enough.
Yeah.
They just didn't.
No, but I will say, Nintendo of America is selling more Wii U's than the NCL is in Japan. So you can shit. I know it's a bigger market, but you can shit all over Reggie and what his team has done in terms of selling this thing. They're still selling more of them than Japan is.
I'm not saying they did a terrible job. I'm just saying they should have advertised more. And I think NCL may say the same thing. Why didn't you push this harder?
Yeah.
My guess is, I mean, to me, it seems more likely this position sort of, we hear less and less about the CEO position until eventually we just don't hear anything about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe one day Iwata says, oh, I'm not the CEO anymore, but neither is anyone else.
I'm the CEO of everything and that's good enough for me. I mean, and because, like I said,
but they could have done that today, and instead, they just said. I mean, they could have already done that, you know. So I don't understand the reason for this very confusing announcement that the CEO of NCL is now also the CEO of NOA. You could have just not done that.
I'm not a corporate lawyer, although I live in a corporate world, and I've reached high enough inside the org chart that I understand this stuff. It's a lot easier to swap a name on a government filing than it is to change, like, the position reporting structure.
Hmm.
And it may be this is mostly just a clerical change. That ultimately, this just makes it easier to sign the documents than it would have been to have eliminated a position and then made a different position the responsible signing officer.
So on that point, you know, you just called it potentially this is entirely a clerical move. So I want to find out, do we have consensus on this? Do any of us think, like so many fans who jumped all over this news today and started speculating wildly on all the different possibilities, do any of us think this will make a significant difference in the way that NOA is run?
No.
Because I don't. I think I agree with James. I think this is basically just kind
I think Reggie's been running
PR
that company
move.
For 5 years, and now he just does his fire reviews over the phone.
If you believe
that Iwata wasn't setting the tone for the company already.
Exactly. That's the whole thing, right? I just think that Japan has been running the show for the last several years, and so this change doesn't really make any difference because it's just basically formalizing what's already been happening.
Yeah.
I was just waiting for this conversation for someone to tell me what the fuck the CEO of Nintendo of America did.
We don't know, and we've never
no one knows.
We've never heard what the CEO does, and even people
potentially
who were
nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
so I guess if that is the case, I think it's not going to change anything.
I mean, you can go back to when Mr. Arakawa was president of Nintendo. He wasn't the face of Nintendo of America.
No.
So I think there's always just been sort of a Japanese person at the company making sure the natives don't set everything on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably what his position is. His job is to make sure they don't get unruly.
So just in the interest of covering the bases here, I've also heard this, you could even call this a conspiracy theory probably, but I think it's in the realm of possibility that Iwata was set up this way so that if and when he has to step down from the CEO of NCL in a couple years because if these problems continue and he can't turn the company around and he can't save the Wii U from the shareholders' wrath, then he can step down into his new position and become the new figurehead. In other words, this is Iwata's dark corner that he's going to get shoved into where he doesn't actually have any power. And then someone else, like even Kimishima, although that seems very far-fetched to me, but someone else will then be promoted to the real CEO of the whole shebang. And then Iwata will retain his sort of honorary position and paycheck, even though he will have been dishonored in this way.
So in Japanese culture, when you get what they call it being put in a corner office, because in Japanese culture you don't want to be in the corner office, you want to be where everything's going on.
Uh huh.
You don't get demoted and put in the corner office. You usually get, at least title wise, promoted,
right,
and shoved in the corner. Uh-huh. So it would be like. They would make the CFO of a senior vice president and a CFO and then push him aside. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, hard demotions. What to me though is, and it if we're going to indulge this theory, because I don't know that there is an obvious successor in position. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was an obvious successor when Yamauchi stepped down. It was Arakawa.
Right.
And
I think Arakawa had resigned before Yamauchi did. Which was kind of his way of saying, I don't want this. I don't deserve it, maybe. I'm not the right guy. And he went off and helped, you know, now he runs the Tetris company along with, Hank Rogers and Alexei Pajitnov. And they all live in Hawaii and make billions of dollars on Tetris tournaments.
Yeah, because keep in mind that Nintendo, up until Iwata took over, had always been in the family. Quite mm-hmm. literally. I mean, it had basically been handed down to sons.
Yeah.
So Arakawa being, he was either a nephew or a son-in-law. I can't remember. It made sense that he would be the next person to get it.
Yeah.
Although he probably would have had to change his name if he'd been made president of the company. Adopt the family name, damn it. I don't quite know who they would give it to if Iwata were to step down. There's no obvious successor in play.
It's not Miyamoto. I mean, let's be real. He's not a businessman, you know.
One of my first thoughts with this was, I think it's interesting that they have put all the power on one person. I thought one of my first thoughts was, wow, that makes it very clean to take Iwata out of there and put mm-hmm. somebody else in and have them run the entire show.
It would, but you'd have to have somebody to put in.
That's fine. I'm not just saying, were they to replace
him, laid off.
That person, Iwata, steps down, somebody else would replace him and come in and run everything right off the bat.
And James, they could hire the president of Toyota. They could hire Ken Kutaragi if they wanted to. I mean,
no,
have to be someone recognizable from within Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. No one within Nintendo is recognizable.
There are candidates. There really are. I mean, you've got, you know, Kensuke Tanabe and various people who have a lot of power within Nintendo, but they're just not household names.
Yeah.
I think they have options there, but it doesn't necessarily have, you know, this kind of thing happens in the corporate world all the time. You bring in some CEO from a totally different industry because they just know how to run a business.
Yeah. No, but I think if they were going to bring in somebody from outside the company, they're going to bust up Iwata's hats. They will push power.
I think what they'll do is they'll just eliminate the NOA CEO. I mean, it was created basically, as far as I can tell, as a courtesy to Kimishima in the first place. It's easy as pie to get rid of that.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about his responsibilities. I think if they were going to bring in an outsider, they would basically divest the CEO of any creative control.
Yeah.
And push that down to a chief creative officer, which I don't think Nintendo has, actually, which is kind of surprising.
Miyamoto kind of is.
Yeah. I mean, my point is that the boundaries of Iwata's job and the CEO title all of a sudden are a lot clearer.
Or they're a lot crazier. I don't know.
They're not very clear to me at all.
Well, there's no longer any, well, I'm the CEO, you know, I'm in charge of the company, but there's also this CEO over here, and I'm kind of CEO of
– Yeah.
There's none of that. It's like you run the whole show.
Every single employee at Nintendo, as far as we know, I mean, there could be some power behind the throne that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. But every single person
– Yamauchi? He's still on the board.
He's still the largest investor in the company.
And he's still on the board.
I mean, everybody serves at Iwata's leisure, effectively. So, yeah, he does kind of have this – I mean, he was effectively already CEO of NOA, even if he was just CEO by proxy. Because he could – I mean –
And now he really is by proxy because, you know,
yeah,
he's
– Literally, yes.
Well, that's
not
the thing.
He's not going to be splitting his time between Japan and America any more than he already is, which is not that much.
Now, if Nintendo of America falters – that is squarely on Iwata's head. That's it.
But if they falter, it's already on his head because, you know, money is NCL's money. They are the same company.
But there's nobody else in the picture now. It's just Reggie and Iwata, and that's it.
Yeah.
I think it was before. I mean, nobody was going to go, oh, Kimishima fucked this shit up.
He was CEO, though, right? He was CEO.
He was CEO the same way I'm CEO. I mean...
I'm saying, though...
I don't know. We're conjecturing a lot.
There is no longer a Nintendo of America CEO. Iwata runs the whole thing, and that's official. So, Nintendo of America screws up. Iwata, what's going on?
Well, it's a fascinating situation. I don't know that we can shed any more light on it right now, and I don't know that we'll ever – I mean, Kimishima was around NOA for 10 years, and we never really learned very much at all about what he did there. So,
a mystery wrapped in an enigma.
Yeah. This may not become any more clear with the passage of time, but – we should move on and talk about video games.
Please.
But we should not. We should continue to talk about corporate
structure.
I have
one more point. If you want to go even more conspiracy theory about it, perhaps they have put all they have put all of the power into his role to make that role more appealing to outsiders that might want the job.
Conspiracy theory. Just a few weeks ago, what's his name? Wada from Square Enix? Resigned?
Hey!
The
Nintendo, I don't know.
The Nintendo Corporation Limited Board would give that a 0% vote.
How about Sakaguchi? He's kind of hanging around, right? He used to run Squaresoft. And then he made a movie.
Guys. He did. He definitely made a movie.
Let's move on to the next email, and John is going to read that one.
All right. Buttle and Jim in BC wrote, ever since I heard the rumor of Nintendo's next console possibly being a portable and home console in one, I didn't hear this rumor, but I can't get it out of my mind.
It's the Wii U, John.
I can't get it out of my mind what a good idea it would be. Do you think it's a real possibility? For starters, droughts have always been a problem for Nintendo, and this would be a big help. If both consoles were combined, there would almost always be something to play. And since portable console buyers would have to buy the home console, perhaps we'd get some more third-party love, since the console would be in so many people's hands. It would be great being able to play portable games on the big screen or console games on the go, though that might not work for all games. And I don't know how Nintendo would handle taking the hit of having their base not buy both a home console and a portable. Could they make up the money by having their combined console be a huge success?
I just, the other game companies are not just game companies. They've got their fingers in many pies, and they got, Sony has so many different electronic products, and Microsoft, of course, is just huge. I'm guessing that Nintendo has this double strategy of having handhelds and consoles to diversify a bit, you know, within their field of expertise. If one thing doesn't work, they have something else to fall back on.
Well, see, here's the thing though. pushing Microsoft out because console gaming is, to them, is the Trojan horse through which they get the Microsoft life.
Yep.
Right.
It's been pretty successful.
It has been, and it will. I mean, that's I guarantee you right now when they're designing their next Xbox, it's the Trojan horse philosophy is going to get ramped way the hell up.
Yeah.
I mean, to them, it's a very small portion of their business. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but their biggest business is selling you fucking Microsoft Word.
But for Sony, the PlayStation is almost the only profitable part of the company.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. This is the thing. Problems. Having it to fall back on doesn't always work because Sony lost money on the PlayStation brand forever and then finally turned it around while everything else went in the shitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, just to get back to the rumor itself, you know, it's been around for a while. And I even remember back before 3DS was announced. So this would have been about four or five years ago. The big rumor was that Nintendo was going to release a portable GameCube. And yet, keep in mind at the time, GameCube had not been dead for very long. It was still, it didn't exactly go out with a bang, but, it was still a fairly recent console. And the idea that Nintendo could take a fairly powerful home console and, you know, compact it down into something that would be portable was pretty exciting because it would have been way more powerful than the PSP, for instance, at the time. And even versus the 3DS now, I'd say the GameCube is still more powerful than 3DS. I don't think there's much question
you might be
about
able,
that.
You might be able to pull off some GameCube games on the 3DS, but not all of them.
Yeah, I mean, look at, you know, even Donkey Kong Country Returns, which is basically a GameCube game. I don't think that game's using the power of the Wii a whole lot, especially since it did have motion control. You know, that game, we're hearing it has performance problems on 3DS. It's got frame rate hits and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, this would have been a pretty big deal, especially like 4 or 5 years ago.
I think that bottle perhaps is referring to like the there were rumors that were sparked when the handheld hardware division and the console hardware division got consolidated recently.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's more of a resource sharing thing.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think that's where the rumors sprung from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the rumors also, I mean, it's the most obvious rumor in the world because look at the freaking Wii U gamepad.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a handheld gaming system in a lot of ways, especially as more and more and more games start supporting the gamepad only play, which, you know, Nintendo is actively patching into older games. And now that's the whole Wii U virtual console thing is predicated on the fact that just playing them on your TV isn't good enough. You want to be able to play it on the gamepad. That's the reason they're going to resell you all those games and make you pay to upgrade them. And that's the main feature that you unlock is, yo, I can play it. It's basically, I can turn these into handheld games. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a natural evolution of what they're already doing, and I think this is extremely possible. I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying it's likely. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's very possible that they could move forward, especially if they continue to struggle with selling the Wii U, and if they never do really figure out how to turn it around. I think they have to be looking forward at saying, how can we even more leverage our strength in the handheld space and make something that can compete with smartphones on a gaming basis because, you know, we can make it literally a console that you hold in your hand. It would be very similar to, for instance, the Vita, which is basically a handheld PlayStation console. It's built like a console. It's built to do all the things a console can do. It just happens to be portable. And in Sony's case, you know, there's many reasons why that's not working well for them. But they're also still supporting a console, you know, two consoles. Whereas the idea here is that, you know, this would be the successor to both Wii U and 3DS, would be one unified platform.
I don't know why you would do that, like, because you wouldn't have one as insurance for the other.
There are obvious advantages in terms of, you know, putting the resources into games, right? Like, I mean, right now the Wii U is having problems. Why? Because it doesn't have games. Why? Because, like, there's not enough teams, I guess, working on games for the Wii U. And, you know, like, Nintendo has their resources split between the handheld and a console. So yeah, there's a very obvious advantage there. But I do agree that if somehow, like, Nintendo decided, okay, we're going to make a console that's more like a handheld, they would have still a quote-unquote second pillar somehow. You know, like I think there would be like the future 3DS, and there would be the future other thing. And that other thing could be, you know, portable, but I do think they would want to try to have, you know, two separate products.
Virtual Boy 2. Yeah. I mean, to me, what you lose out on here, if you have a single platform, is you lose out on the developer licenses. And I mean, that is a big part of money making in the hardware business.
Yeah. But if people stop making games for your systems, you're losing them that way too.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to lose it anyway. It's sort of the cart, you know, you put the cart before the horse. You just say, we're going to cut it off and you can come work with us for this. But what if they say, well, it's not a great handheld and it's not a great console. They'll skip it anyway.
Well, let me propose this. What if the second pillar that Guillaume says, I think you're right, as a business, because they don't have, because they don't make TVs and they don't make, you know, music players and they don't make computers.
They do make love testers.
No, not anymore. Only in the museum.
They should.
You know, all their eggs are in this one basket. And I do think they would want to have a second product. That's the thing. If you think about these platforms as their products, Nintendo right now only has two products. And if they go down to one and that one struggles, then they're really fucked. So I do think they would want to have a secondary product. But what if that product is not hardware? What if it's a service? And a service that would be heavily invested in the one unified platform, but could also be ported to other things. I mean, what if Virtual Console as a service, as a library of classic video games that are cheap and affordable and work really well, what if that now becomes portable to other platforms? So what if you can access all your Virtual Console games on your PC, on competing consoles, on your smartphone or whatever, then that's something that Nintendo can rely on for, you know, and it becomes a subscription-based service or whatever. There's a lot of different ways you can spin it. But what if that is the secondary product? And they say, well, all the games on the Virtual Console service that you pay us for will work awesome on this new combined, you know, handheld console thing that we're doing. But you also get more bang for your buck by having access to it on your other devices as well.
Well, the thing is with that, that becomes less exclusive, though. That's something that they hold as exclusive to their consoles.
I don't know that anybody's found a good mechanism for monetizing that particular business plan. I mean, there are people out there doing it right now. We had GameTap not that long ago, and they went belly up.
But Nintendo is doing it already better than GameTap. I mean, they've got
they've got
their own platforms, which is the main draw, but they've also got the Genesis stuff and the Neo Geo stuff and the TurboGrafx stuff, and all that is wrapped together, and they do a better job of it, you know?
There were 1,000 games available at the height of that service.
But they worked really poorly on GameTap.
They did.
It was a messed up platform, and
it was. But I'm just saying, it's really hard.
Then they opened
an
editorial arm, James, and now they're writing like video games coverage and covering E3, and it was a total mess.
Well, part of that was a corporate failure, in that they merged it back under Turner Entertainment, which is the same division that ran fucking Adult Swim. I mean, the whole thing is just absurd chaos.
Hey, I think they would lose something here with third parties. Like they wouldn't have the pull anymore to get third parties to publish their Nintendo games on the Nintendo Virtual Console service. I mean, like, you say that, oh, they have the Genesis, they have the TurboGrafx, but, you know, Sega has been releasing the same Virtual Console games on Steam. Is there a reason why they wouldn't want to make a deal with Nintendo again and just...
They would,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, they would want to wrap it into Nintendo's service, not exclusively, just like you said, because you can buy those, you know, those old Genesis games in 100 different ways.
Yeah.
But they would want to be included in the Virtual Console service because Nintendo's games are included in the Virtual Console service. And that makes it a uniquely appealing flavor of this kind of product. And it means that more people will play and ultimately pay for access to all their old Genesis games because they're sitting next to Super Mario World, which is very different than selling them a la carte on Steam, or even having their own Sega subscription service, which I don't know that they're ever really going to go that route. Nintendo can do that. Most other companies can't. But Nintendo can also say, come along for the ride, guys. We'll make you some money. You know, so I'm not saying they're ever going to do this, but I think they could. I'm just proposing that if they wanted to retain a second pillar, like you said, and I think they would, it doesn't necessarily have to be a second piece of hardware. So that would allow them to combine the handheld and the console together, just like this rumor says that Buttle wrote us about, and still have a backup plan, still have supplementary income that is, you know, very valuable to them. And that will always, I mean, people will always want to play Super Mario Brothers to the end of time. That will have some value to people. And over time, their library just grows and grows and grows. So, I mean, that's very appealing.
I just think that they would be squandering that value and having that type of service, because that's the kind of stuff they want to have exclusive. In other words...
But nobody's buying a Wii U because of the virtual console service. It's not an asset to them.
But that's the thing. But I don't think the answer to that is giving that away to everybody.
Nobody's going to pay to have Super Mario Brothers on their laptop because they can already get it.
Well, they can illegally, but most people don't know how.
It's really fucking easy.
And if they make it just like iTunes, if they make it easy and affordable to do it legally, people will prefer to do it legally. That's been demonstrated. Same with Netflix. So
people still pirate Steam games. They do.
But it's a very small sliver of the audience. So I just want to defend my position here. I think this is a pretty good idea. I think they could do it. But virtual console alone is not a system selling feature. So selling access to it outside of Nintendo platforms is a possibility in the future, I think.
Well, I just think that with the resource argument, in other words, we don't have enough teams to go around to make stuff for 3DS and for Wii U. I think Nintendo's kind of backed themselves into a corner with that, because that's partially a problem of their own creation, because they have to carry the weight for their consoles at this point, because they don't get the support from third parties that they used to get, way back.
When was this magical time?
That's the thing. From Super NES, Nintendo, pretty much. Nintendo. But that's the thing. Nintendo has created that, though. So they have to sit there and carry the load, and all their dev teams have to carry the load for the console
On DS, pretty damn good third-party support. Not great in America, but overall, pretty good.
And the DS support and 3DS support in Japan is, in my mind, is pretty good.
Japanese companies, that's exactly
it. It's getting better.
It still sucks in the US, but it's no different from the DS.
It's getting better. A lot of companies were still hanging on to PSP because it was successful in Japan, and then some of them were betting on Vita and have now given up on that, and they're slowly adopting 3DS. So 3DS is building momentum. I don't think it's there yet, even in Japan, for third-party support. But it's getting better, and it will get there. I mean, Square is still dog shit on 3DS, Square Enix.
Yeah.
Compared to their support of DS,
joke. Their DS support didn't come right out the gate either, didn't it?
It was slow. It was. I would just say I think a handheld console from Nintendo is a distinct possibility. I think it could be a good thing. It's a risk for the reasons that we described, but... it could be a good thing. I think, whether third parties will support it or not is, to me, is beside the point. I mean, Nintendo's struggles with third parties are what they are, and I don't think they would necessarily be hurt or helped by doing something like this. I think there are ways to fix Nintendo's third party support that are totally separate from this question. That's my opinion. Okay, guys, so we spent so much time on these two emails that we're not going to be able to get any more on this episode, but... There's always next time. Yes, there will be next time, I promise. Again, we're planning to do retroactive next week, but we'll get back to mail very soon after that. And we always welcome your letters. So thanks everyone for writing in. Please keep writing in. We will not throw away your emails, I promise you. We will try to get to some of the really good ones we've had lately. And the address, again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Or you can click on the link in the show article over at NWR. And again, just a quick reminder that the retroactive thread is open now. The discussion is ongoing for Mega Man 3. It's a short game. There's a lot of fun stuff to talk about, I think. So I hope you are going to play along with us. If you are, go ahead and get started now. Post your comments in the forum thread. You've got a few days to get those in, and on the next episode, we're going to be talking about the game, and we're going to pull in as many of those quotes as we can from the forums. So I hope you'll check that out. Of course, there will be a link in the show article for that as well. So that's it for this time. Thanks, everybody. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back next time with lots more video games.
Bye.
Early ejection.
Later.